Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Donald Crable, the Distinguished College Professor and Senior Fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He is perhaps the world's foremost authority on Anabaptist groups and has written a large number of books on the topic, including Horse and Buggy Mennonites, Hoofbeats of Humility in a Postmodern World, The Amish Way, Patient Faith in a Perilous World, Amish Grace, How Forgiveness Transcended Tragedy, and most recently, The Amish, which with his co-authors Karen Johnson Weiner and Stephen Nolte is one of the most comprehensive and accessible books on the topic available today. We will link to those books as well as Professor Crable's personal website where you can investigate more of his writings, and there are a lot of them to investigate, so please do check it out. Don, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Our topic for today is the Amish, a religious group that is highly recognizable by their distinct dress and way of life, but I have to admit, I actually know very little about. Now, the idea for this podcast came to me a few weeks back when I was sitting at one of my favorite watering holes in a show called The Amish Mafia, a drama purportedly based upon true events, popped up on the television. Now, I realize that this might be one of the few sources of information that people have about the Amish population, so I figured it'd be best that I beef up my knowledge a bit more than what cable television has to offer, so that's why I am contacting you. Our discussion today is going to be fairly basic, looking at the background of the Amish and related religious groups such as the Old Order Mennonites. But first, I'm wondering if Professor Crable has any thoughts on that TV show. Are the Amish merely just a soft and fuzzy front for an organized crime syndicate?
Well, to be very honest, Tony, the Amish Mafia is simply, in my judgment, fundamentally fraudulent. These are not real Amish people that are acting. Most of them grew up in one way or another in an Amish community, but they never joined, and they're not in any way practicing with Amish communities today. The stories that they are using are fabricated and created up. They're in the imagination of the producers. What gives it a realistic sense is that the people who are acting know enough about Amish culture that they can create a scene or a situation that gives an impression of authenticity. These are not reenactments, and the use of violence, the idea of a mafia, is simply utterly false. And unfortunately, what this does is just disseminates all kinds of stereotypes and misperceptions of the Amish that are simply not true. I've gotten a lot of emails from people saying, well, what parts are true or what parts aren't? Well, none of it really is true. And for me, the most objectionable thing is that Discovery keeps saying, oh, these are real people. These people live in the Amish community. These are real Amish events. If Discovery simply said, we want to have some fun and laugh at the Amish, that would be one thing. But to continually propose and suggest and give the impression that it's real, I just find despicable. So I would say the other issue is, what do you think might happen if there'd be a show like this called the Catholic Mafia or the Baptist Mafia or the Mormon Mafia? The public relations people for those denominations and religions would be all over the place with anti-defamation suits. So knowing that the Amish don't have any public relation apparatus, don't have any centralized government, don't believe in the use of litigation. They are sitting ducks for this kind of foolishness. Well, end of story.
Yeah, well, okay, so I learned today that I can't trust everything on cable television. I have to admit, though, that I'm disappointed by networks like the Discovery Channel that it's supposed to be about learning and education, and yet they're going to these fabricated reality shows that, I don't know.
Well, it's been a big shift in their programming.
Yeah.
Since they have new ownership, and National Geographic's the same. It's no longer owned by National Geographic. And so there are a number of channels that have historically were quote-unquote educational channels and had a good sense of credibility, which have dramatically shifted their programming.
Yeah, there's the History Channel, which is basically all Bigfoot and UFOs nowadays. So, but that is why we are here. We are to fill that educational gap. And given that the Amish, as well as related communities such as the Mennonites, are relatively unknown to me and probably many of my listeners, I thought it'd be a great idea to fill in some of that background, to do a general survey of these communities, with an emphasis on the Amish, who seem to capture the public attention a little bit more than the Mennonites. I don't think as many people know about Mennonite communities. So let's go ahead and talk about their origins, history, theology, cultural practices, and then we'll turn to an examination of their communities in contemporary times. And along the way, I plan to be asking a few questions that I solicited from some of our listeners via Facebook. And this is a fairly new practice. I'm going to see if it flies or not. So if you are interested in participating in the show by submitting questions for forthcoming shows, please check out our Facebook fan page for this. So let's start with the origins and history. Let's talk about the Amish and Mennonites. From where and whence do these groups of folks originate?
Both groups, Amish and Mennonites, originate with the Anabaptist movement at the time of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and to be more precise, 1525 in Zurich, Switzerland. And the word Anabaptist referred to being twice baptized or rebaptized. So the Anabaptists had grown up in a Catholic tradition, and they were arguing with Zwingli in Zurich, the Reformed pastor, that people should be given a voluntary decision whether or not they wanted to join the church, and it should be an adult decision. And they were arguing for adult baptism, and many of them rebaptized themselves, and they were called twice baptizers or Anabaptists because they had already been baptized as infants in the Catholic Church. The deeper issue here, however, was a separation of church and state authority because Zwingli, the Reformed pastor, said, well, let's take this issue of adult baptism to the Zurich City Council. And the Anabaptists said, no, we think the Bible has a higher authority than civil government. So in a sense, the deeper issue was not so much adult baptism as it was the ultimate authority and how you distinguish between government authority and biblical or religious authority on religious questions. Eventually, the Anabaptist movement spreads. There's a stream of it in the north, it's Dutch in the Netherlands, Dutch, northern German Anabaptists. Some of them go to Poland, some to Russia. They come to the United States and North America as a separate wave. The Amish are part of the South German Swiss Anabaptist movement, and the Amish developed their own identity about 170 years later in 1693. They are influenced somewhat by Pietism, also influenced somewhat by the Dutch Anabaptists to the north, but the Amish identity emerges in 1693, and by that time, many of the other Anabaptists were known as Mennonites from their leader, Menno Simons, who was a Dutch former Catholic priest.
Now, 1693 seems to be a pretty specific date to create an identity. You know, a lot of people say, well, my identity emerges over a long period of time, but 1693, that's very specific. Is there something that happened in that year?
Well, there was a sharp division in the Swiss Anabaptist community, and Jacob Ammann was a young convert who argued for renewal And that led to this division in 1693, and the word Amish comes from his name, Jacob or Jakob Amen. So it was, that's when the controversy came to a head. It would have been happening over a three-year period, but 1693 is sort of the marker for it.
Okay. And so what happens after 1693?
Both Mennonites and Amish immigrate to the New World, and this is happening basically from 1710 through the 18th century. Some Amish migration continues into the early 19th century, basically in two waves. Before the revolution, the American Revolution, and also then into the early part of the 19th century. The only part of that that varies is many of the Dutch, German, Dutch, and eventually Russian Mennonites, they come over in the latter part of the 19th century and also the early part of the 20th century. So, but that is a completely separate group from the Amish, and many of the Dutch, Russian Mennonites went into Canada and into the western parts of the United States.
That, I want to come back to where they migrated in the United States a little bit later on, because I'm fascinated about the location of these folks and where they end up. And I'll be asking here in a second about Pennsylvania. That's the area we tend to associate most with the Amish. But why were these folks leaving Europe? Is there specific reasons? Religious persecution, the economy just sucked?
Religious persecution. I mean, they had endured a great deal of religious persecution in the 16th century. Several thousand were burned at the stake. I mean, to refuse to have your child baptized, whether you're Protestant or Catholic, and to baptize adults was considered a capital offense. And so they got the medieval equivalent electric chair, burning at the stake, decapitated, drowned in lakes and rivers and so on in prison. But when they came here in the early part of the 18th century, there was still some persecution, so they were attracted to Philadelphia and Pennsylvania for religious liberty, also for good farmland, and also because of all the unrest and the wars, various wars at that time in Germany. So it was basically for a more peaceful environment as well as religious freedom.
Now, are there any residual communities that still exist in Europe? Did they all make it over here? Did some of them, I know a number of Mennonites went into Russia. Are there still Russian Mennonite communities that exist today, even in very small pockets?
There are Russian Mennonite communities, but they no longer call themselves Mennonites. But many of those in the last 30 years have come out of Russia into Eastern Germany. And so there are Mennonites still in the Netherlands and in Germany and in Switzerland. There are no Old Order Mennonites there. The Old Order thing is a phenomenon of the late 19th century here in the U.S. And the last Amish congregation in Europe closed in 1937.
Okay. Explain that term, Old Order, because we get Mennonites and we get Old Order Mennonites and we get Anabaptists and we get Old Order and Anabaptists. What labels you as an Old Order?
The term Old Order emerged here in the U.S. In the 1870s and 1880s. And this is after the Civil War. There's industrialization is starting to kick in. And there's a lot of change taking place in Anabaptist communities, Mennonite and Amish. And there were numerous divisions in the 1880s where some groups wanted to have more progressive things like revivalism, Sunday schools, speaking English in church instead of German. And it led to divisions both in the Amish church as well as in the Mennonite church. And the groups that wanted to stay with the old Ordnung, or the old way of doing things, which would be no Sunday school, in the Amish case, not using meeting houses, not speaking English in the church service, those more traditional groups became known as Old Order. The others became known more as mainstream Mennonites, and those who were more progressive Amish eventually merged with mainstream Mennonites. So they pretty much blended in and were grafted into the Mennonite church.
Let me go ahead and start to probe some of the theological and cultural practices of these groups. Now, we've already touched upon some of this just a moment ago when we were talking about these old order groups. But there's a number of things that people associate with the old order groups, the Amish specifically, that I would be interested in if there's theological justifications or if these are cultural practices. Let's just go down a little bit of list with some of these things. One of them is distinctive beards and long hair for women. What is that about?
That's a practice in the Amish, and the beard was always understood as the way God made us, they would say. It's a natural growth of hair, and they would also say it's a way to differentiate between men and women. In terms of differentiating between the sexes, they would refer to 1 Corinthians, I believe, is it 11, where there's a discussion of women's veiling and long hair, that it would be, a sign of her, a woman's glory, quote-unquote, so to speak, to God, to have long hair and also to wear a prayer covering, which in some of the groups, they'd wear it on a daily basis, I mean, during the day in terms of work and so on. So with the Old Order Mennonites, and by the way, when I'm using Old Order here today now, I'm referring to horse and buggy driving Mennonites, Old Order Mennonites, and horse and buggy driving Amish. And with the horse and buggy driving Old Order Mennonites, the men are clean shaven, but the women, Old Order women, Mennonite women, would have long hair and wear a prayer covering, a prayer veiling.
Now, you use the term horse and buggy. Is that a term that they embrace? Is it a term that we as scholars have given them or that the culture in large has given them? Why use that term horse and buggy?
It is a practice that these two groups use, and they, like other Mennonites and the Mennonite horse and buggy Mennonites themselves, would refer to themselves as team Mennonites, meaning the team is the carriage and the horse. Mm-hmm. For scholars, it's a typical way to designate them, and I would argue it's the most distinctive way to mark the difference of their culture. It basically means they reject the ownership of automobiles, and it's very central to their identity and central to their social and church organization, because it limits how much autonomy an individual has in terms of traveling. They view the car as something that would fragment and pull their communities apart. The Old Order Amish do not have church buildings. They are organized into church districts with specific boundaries, and there are about 25 to 35 families in each of those districts with explicit geographical boundaries, like an old European Catholic parish. And so having horse and buggy transportation is a kind of social glue that holds the community together and enhances face-to-face interaction.
Go ahead.
Having said that, most Amish groups will also, in addition to using horse and buggy for local transportation, they will hire outside English drivers to take them, if they have to go longer distance, 20 miles or 30 miles to a funeral or a wedding, or for business purposes. But they they're not allowed to own automobiles or have licenses or drive them. So there is this kind of use of quote-unquote informal taxi service provided by outside so-called English people.
That's very interesting, and I've seen pictures of Amish farmers with horse and buggies, but they're pulling behind the buggy or behind the horse team a John Deere thresher. Modern equipment, and
correct,
that's fine to do, right?
Correct. They use the older Amish use horses in the field, but they will pull behind a horse modern equipment, and they will adapt it. The modern equipment would have been made for a tractor and powered by the tractor's power takeoff shaft, but they install a sizable gasoline engine on this piece of equipment, a hay baler or harvester of some kind, and that provides the power for it, but the horses pull it in the field. Now, the Old Order Mennonites use tractors in the field, but tractors on steel wheels. And the logic to both of these is that if you permit tractors on the road, on rubber tires, that will eventually lead to a pickup truck and lead to a car, and it will just increase the mobility and, again, fragment the community. So there's a kind of, some of these things look silly to us from the outside, but there, in fact, is a kind of deep cultural logic to it that makes a lot of sense when you look at it in historical perspective and what the social consequences would be if everybody had a car.
And that is absolutely fascinating, because you think with the advent of the car, and especially with the advent of the modern highway system after World War II, people disperse all over the place. You get the fragmentation of extended families down to the nuclear family, and you could see this happening throughout the United States in the 20th century. But
precisely,
I'm assuming that this is something that they were adopting back in the early 20th century, so they must have had some good foresight in terms of understanding the implications of all this technology.
Yeah, well, they never accepted cars, and I think at that point they're just trying to find their way, and they felt these were toys of rich people. They'd come out from the cities driving their cars, and there was no need for them to have them, and it eventually sort of gelled into a tradition that was affirmed by the church. And so I would say, as a sociologist, that is the best way to mark old order culture, because once you get a car, I mean, I've seen it again and again in many different groups. Once you get a car, step across that boundary, a lot of other things happen. Then you get a meeting house, and then two or three generations, you know, the children are far from any semblance of old order culture.
Oh, yeah. Once a teenager gets a car, you don't see the teenager anymore.
Exactly.
I know how that is. Here's another interesting marker or cultural marker is the clothing, the distinct clothing. We talked already a little bit about the women's hair covering, but when I think of Amish, when you look up Amish on the interwebs, you come up with pictures of people in the, if they're more formal, they'll be dressed in the black suit, or if they're working in the fields, they have the suspenders. I've also heard something that they don't have buttons on their clothes. Is that true?
Well, one thing I should, before I answer that, let me say this, Tony. In North America, there are about 290, in the United States, there are about 290,000 Amish people, okay, in 31 states, and they are in 470 different geographical communities, and they have about 2,100 local congregations, which, as I indicated, we call church districts. The ultimate theological authority is in those local districts. And there are some 40 different Amish tribes. I use tribe intentionally here because they're kind of like loosely organized together. And all of those tribes have different dress practices. Historically, Amish people did not have buttons in their clothing, but some of these tribes, the more progressive ones, they will wear buttons in their everyday clothing, but not on the clothing for church. Mm. They would have what they call hooks and eyes for their Sunday go-to-meeting clothing. The more traditional tribes would still not have any buttons on their clothing. And buttons, this comes back to Industrial Revolution, and even in Europe, the buttons were viewed as a form of ornamentation, ostentatious in terms of their clothing, and a source of pride and individualism. And so that's what created the taboo, so to speak, against the buttons historically.
Let
me also say, you are exactly right. The clothing, next to the horse and buggy, the clothing is a very crucial boundary of ethnic identity, and it does two things. Number one, it clearly draws a line in the sand between Amish people and everybody outside. And secondly, it unifies and pulls them together in terms of their community. It's a kind of team uniform. And so you know which team you're on all the time, and because you're wearing that uniform, it influences how you act if you're a member of the team, but it also shapes how you think about everybody else in the outside that doesn't wear the uniform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And language, too. I assume that this would do it, serve as a very similar marker as well, that they speak an old form of German or a distinct form of German.
They speak all the Amish groups and older Mennonite groups, with one small segment in Indiana. All of them, 98% of them, speak Pennsylvania Dutch, which is a German dialect comes from the Alsace region of eastern France, which is along the Platte and along the Rhine River in southern Germany. It was a dialect from that region that they imported here in the 18th century when they came here, and it has evolved, but there's some English words in it, but it's still very much a German dialect, and that is their oral language. They rarely write in it. They don't read it. They typically write in English. They read English, but they also many of them read old German, like Martin Luther German, sort of at the beginning of the era of modern German, so to speak. So they're really trilingual in many ways.
Mm.
And you're right. I mean, that is cohesive. That again is a good marker of who's on the team and who's not. So when I go and interview an Amish person, the moment they see me, they'll talk to me in English. But the moment I walk out the door, they're back into Pennsylvania Dutch.
Wow, that's fascinating. And the children are educated in this from the get-go, right?
Well, the children are educated the children growing up as a 1 or 2 year old, they learn Pennsylvania Dutch. But when they go to school, and most of the kids go to private Amish schools, 95% would be in private Amish schools, one room or two room schools, there they learn English, many of them for the first time. So there are Amish teachers teaching them English, but they learn that the schools are conducted in English. But when they go out in the playground, then they may shift to Pennsylvania German, Pennsylvania Dutch.
There's one other cultural marker here that captures the popular imagination. This is related to the automobile to some extent, and that is the aversion to electricity. Explain this in detail, since I think it does confuse a lot of people.
Well, first of all, the Old Order Mennonites do use electricity off of the public grid. Now, they came to that in many rural communities, the electric public grid was coming into the communities from 1925, actually, to World War II. And so the Old Order Mennonites were slow adapters of it, but the Amish have rejected it. Interestingly, they do not object to electricity per se. They use batteries. They've used batteries since the beginning of the 20th century. And they still use batteries a great deal. Their objection to the public grid was that it would link them to the outside world and it would bring too many conveniences. And this objection and their decision to, forbid connections would have been happening in the 1920s and the 1930s. And the earliest use of electricity was primarily for the house. And I think there's some gender things here, because a lot of, the first 10 or 15 years when a property would have electricity, many times it would have been simply as a convenience in the house, and it wasn't needed in the barn. And so they made the decision that, if they accept electricity, there's going to be too many other things coming. When television came then in the 1950s, it kind of legitimated and vindicated their decision about electricity. And after that, with other kinds of media coming into the houses, into homes in the 70s and 80s, they didn't have to decide about, well, are we going to have a microwave, or are we going to have a radio, or are we going to have a DVD player or a computer, because of the bigger decision not to accept electricity off of the grid. Many of them now are using solar, and there are many Amish business people that actually install solar, and so they are using solar for not to electrify an entire house, but for more specific purposes like running a copy machine, running a coffee maker, perhaps, in limited ways.
Mm-hmm. And what other things might they be using batteries for? I know today you just mentioned copy machine. That surprised me to see an Amish using a copier.
Well, historically they were using batteries for flashlights, but now in many of their shops, if you go into a hardware store, there's all kinds of battery tools, screwdrivers, drills, on and on. They are using all of that modern technology in their shops for manufacturing and so on. The other thing they are doing, and by the way, about two-thirds of them are not farming. Two-thirds are either working in shops or they're entrepreneurs that own shops. The major source of power they would use is a diesel engine, like a diesel engine from a tractor-trailer truck, and they use that diesel engine to operate a hydraulic pump or an air pneumatic pump, and they have Amish mechanics and engineers who convert heavy machinery, like a large table saw or a large sander for a furniture shop, designed a machine like that designed to be operated with electricity. They strip the electric motor off and replace it with either a hydraulic or an air pneumatic motor, and then the diesel engine provides the source to operate that kind of large machinery in many Amish shops. So it's kind of like quote-unquote Amish electricity, meaning it's pneumatic and hydraulic instead of typical electricity off of the public grid.
That is fascinating, and I have to ask this question. I was going to talk about community relations with the non-Amish world a little bit later, but now that you brought this issue of diesel engines up, I mean, diesel engines make a lot of noise. They tend to be stinkier than other types of ways you could get electricity from. Are they able to get special permits that exempt them from city zoning ordinances, or are they encapsulated
None of them live in cities. There aren't any Amish people. It's the one. There are very few generalizations I can make, but the one is all Amish people are living in rural areas. And so there, for example, in Lancaster County here in eastern Pennsylvania where I live, we have maybe 40 townships, and they each have their own zoning code. So those kind of issues would need to be sorted out with the local zoning officials in each local township. And in Lancaster County here where Amish people have had 250 years of history with, the local non-Amish population, typically there's very amicable relationships and collaborative relationships, because in our case, the Amish are also a real financial asset because of tourism. We have 10 million tourists coming in here a year, and if the Amish were to leave, it would be a major blow to the economy of the local area here.
Yeah. Yeah, especially with the Penn State football team not doing too well recently.
Right.
Yeah, there's that too. Let me go ahead and step back to theological practices. And one of the questions that is asked on our Facebook page comes from Bud Kelstedt, who is a political scientist. He's interested in how the Amish and the Mennonites are classified in terms of the genealogical tree of Christianity. Some people claim that they're evangelicals, and he's wondering where would they fit in this whole scheme of things.
Well, I need to back up and just give a little bit of context. So far, we've been talking about the Old Order horse and buggy driving Mennonites and the Old Order horse and buggy driving Amish, okay?
Okay.
I've said earlier there's about 290,000 Amish in the United States. If you look at Mennonites, there's about 350,000 Mennonites. The horse and buggy driving ones only make up about 10% of the 350,000. The other 90% of the Mennonites, half of those are what I call conservative, car-driving, plain-dressing Mennonites who use electricity and so on, tend to be a little more rural, tend to be fairly conservative. They would use evangelical language. They would be involved in mission work and so on. The other 45% of the Mennonites are mainstream Mennonites that have PhDs, that own software companies, that maybe teach at Harvard or Princeton. They're kind of like mainstream assimilated Mennonites. Some of those would be very evangelical in their thinking. Others would not be evangelical and would identify more with sort of old mainline Protestant, you know, theological things. So if we come back now and just talk about the old order Mennonites, the 10% of the Mennonite world, and talk about all of the Amish, the old order Amish, I would say they are definitely not, they would not wear an evangelical tag, okay? And for example, the older Amish are loath to say that, I know I'm saved, I'm sure I'm saved, and so on. They would say that's a rather arrogant statement, because who are we to say whether we are saved or not? They would say, well, that's really God's judgment. I mean, isn't God the one that should make that judgment? Who are we to second-guess God's mind? So there's a deep sense of theological humility here. They also would say that they are concerned that if you say, I'm saved and I know I'm saved, it will separate ethics from soteriology, so that you kind of have this parallel system. You have ethics on the one hand and salvation, soteriology talk on the other hand, whereas the Amish, older Amish and older Mennonites, it would be much more holistic, that ethics and salvation are closely tied together. They would reject the idea that it's a works document, a works doctrine, but they would emphasize for all of these groups, even the mainstream Mennonites, the focus would be on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, that is, you know, we are disciples, it's a discipleship tradition. What matters is not the evangelical language necessarily, or words like born again, but what matters is, are we following in the way of Jesus every day? What does it mean to follow daily, pick up my cross, and follow Jesus daily in life per his teachings on the Sermon on the Mount and so on? The other idea they related to the salvation question is, they would say we have a living hope. And by that they mean that we have confidence that when we die, God will be a gracious and merciful judge. But it would be arrogant of us to say now that we're saved and we're sure we're saved. But rather they use this language of a living hope. So I would say, in terms of the old order groups, they use different language. It's more communal. And I'm somewhat critical of evangelicals who are sometimes critical of the Amish and say they're not saved, they're all going to hell, they're just, you know, following this kind of works doctrine and so on. I have a book called The Amish Way. It's a sequel to the book Amish Grace on the nickel mine shooting. And in The Amish Way, with two colleagues, we really articulate Amish spirituality. And it's, I think, the most helpful introduction for anyone that's interested in really digging deeper into the nature of Amish theology, so to speak.
Well, we will link to that on our website so people can track that down. And your writings is very accessible. So for those who want some theological understanding of all this stuff, and my strong suit is not theology, these are great books to actually be looking into. Is there a theological difference, or a large theological difference, between Old Order Mennonites and the Amish? Or is this largely an ethnic distinction between these two groups?
It's largely an ethnic distinction. Okay. I would say their theological understandings are similar. In fact, both groups would go back to what they call the 18 Articles of Faith. It's like a confession of faith, which was written by the Dutch Mennonites in 1632. So for baptism, both groups, both Old Order Mennonites and Old Order Amish, would use the Dordrecht. It's in the town of Dordrecht in the Netherlands. It was signed there, would use the 1632 Dortrecht Confession of Faith.
Okay. Here's another question. This comes from Dave Dixon, who's been a guest on our show before, and he wants to know if there's a tension between the educational requirements of the Amish community and the ability to formalize or systematize a theology. He's basically asking, are there Amish seminaries? Because he has mentioned to me that there is a Mennonite seminary in Elkhart, Indiana, and I assume that's probably not an Old Order Mennonite seminary.
That's correct.
But the bigger question goes to, how is the theological tradition passed on? Are there religious authorities that make determinations? And has the theology stayed relatively consistent over the past few hundred years?
Well, the question about seminaries is really easy. It's a single little two-letter word, no.
Mm-hmm.
The Old Order Mennonites, Horse and Buggy Mennonites, and the Old Order Amish do not have any trained, theologically trained pastors. There's no theological program for them. They are ordained by lot, using the biblical procedure of the lot, where of casting lots, and so they are. They have an eighth grade education. They've never gone to high school. The selection process takes about 90 minutes, and there may be five or six people nominated, all men nominated by the congregation. And then when the lots are cast, one of those gets the lot and is ordained minister or deacon. Or if they need a bishop, then there would be several ministers in the lot for bishop. But it's a quick, abrupt thing. It's not something anybody would ever seek. It's a heavy burden and responsibility. There's no theological training with it. There's no pay for it. You do it in addition to your regular job as a carpenter, farmer, or a florist or whatever. So, to answer the question of your reader, there really is no sophisticated theology. There's no central source of theology. There are magazines. There are four or five Amish magazines that would have essays written by various ministers expressing their thoughts about things. They would emphasize strongly the Bible, and especially the New Testament. All of the scriptures, Tony, all of the scriptures that are read in the Amish church service come from the New Testament. Now, the ministers will tell stories from the Old Testament, but again, it's the discipleship tradition. There's not really theological, doctrinal, systematic theology, nothing like that in this community. It's a focus on how do we practice our faith? It's about praxis rather than orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Now, let me make a comment about the seminary at Elkhart. That represents the mainstream assimilated Mennonites, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The 10% or Old Order Mennonites wouldn't send anybody there. The 45% who are conservative, plain-dressing Mennonites would rarely send anybody there. And so the assimilated Mennonites, the 45% that are more mainstream, they are the ones that support the seminary and run the seminary, and it produces pastors, professional pastors, who would be paid and salaried to lead Mennonite congregations across the United States and Canada and North America.
Let's move over to the demographics of this population now, and you've already given us some numbers. You said there's about 290,000 Amish or so, and about 350,000 Mennonites, and then you further broke this down into conservative Mennonites, and then 10% are horse and buggy Mennonites.
Yes.
Give us an overview through those different categories of whether this religious population is growing, shrinking, stable.
Right.
What's happening to it?
Let me talk about the Old Order Amish first. They are doubling about every 18 to 20 years, and that has been the case since about 1950. They were not doubling nearly that fast in the first half of the 20th century, but since 1950, the Amish doubling rate is 18 to 20 years. And it's primarily driven by biological reproduction because the families are sizable with typically 6 to 10 children. On the average, I would say it's 7 or 8 children, but they're in the more traditional tribes, the family size would be larger. Can outsiders join? Yes. Do some join? Yes, but not too often. There are probably somewhere between 50 and 100 Amish adults today who have joined from the outside. And the Amish welcome them, but the Amish are not do not engage in evangelism or any kind of proselytizing activities. The way I've just described the older Amish would pertain almost precisely the same to the Old Order horse and buggy Mennonites. With the conservative Mennonites, the plain-dressing, car-driving conservative Mennonites, their growth is probably similar, but they would engage, some of them would engage in mission activities and mission work. The mainstream Mennonites, the ones that operate the seminary at Elkhart, Indiana, they're the denomination there is a is the growth rate is pretty flat. And the reason is these people use birth control. The typical family size would be two children, one child. Their family disperses all over the country because they have professional jobs. There, some live in Los Angeles, some in Germany, some in Alabama, and some in Toronto. And so when you have that kind of dispersion, some of them join other churches. The mainstream Mennonites have a lot of mission and evangelistic activity. So they have new people, more new people coming in, but they're also lose many of their own people simply because their jobs take them other places, and also, as I said before, because the family size is so small.
Now, one of the things that I've heard about the Old Order communities is that they allow their, I guess, older teens a year or two out in the quote-unquote real world, or the non-Amish world, I think is a better way of putting it, to see if they really want to come back or not. Is that an actual practice, or is that just an urban myth?
That's an urban myth.
Okay.
The way it operates is this way. Recall these people, all the Anabaptist groups emphasize adult baptism. And the way the older Mennonites and older Amish would define it, that would mean, you know, roughly between the ages of 18 and 22 or something like that. When an Amish young person turns 16, there's a rite in their community, much like getting a driver's license used to be in mainstream American culture. And until they are 16, they are always at home on weekends. They always do things in the context of their family. When they turn 16, a young man will typically get a carriage, and there are youth gatherings in the area, youth groups that they can attend, typically on Saturday evening, Sunday afternoon, sometimes Sunday evening. And they go there on their own. I mean, they're not. There is some parental supervision at those, but they're able to socialize with their friends. They would get into sports, nature things, swimming, ice hockey, play a lot of volleyball. That's kind of like a really big thing. And some of those young people, see, they are not baptized yet, and they're not under the regulations of the church. They've not made a commitment of Christian faith. And so some of them would get cars, probably less than 10%. Some would go to cities, some would have keg parties, a few would use drugs sometimes, but the number that do that is probably around 10%, 15%, I'm making up numbers here, but the point is the bulk of them would not be interacting a lot with the outside world, but some of them would. And at some point, they will need to decide, are they going to join the Amish community or not? And typically about 85 to 90% do, in fact, join the Amish community. There are a few that may go to New York and live there for a year, or Chicago, but a very small amount. I mean, less than one-half of 1% probably. So the parents are not encouraging them to go out. It's just this in between time, where they're betwixt and between the regulations and control of their parents and the regulations of the church. And nobody really, I mean, they're sort of like American teenagers, it's pretty hard to specify very precisely what an 18 or 19-year-old does.
Yeah.
But most of them eventually join the church. But most of them are living at home in their local community during this period that's called Rumspringa. And Rumspringa is a Pennsylvania German word that means running around. It means, as I said, when they're 16, they can now run around with their peers and hang out with them on weekends.
You mentioned cake parties, and that just prompted another question that you could answer briefly here. Are the Old Order Amish and the Old Order Mennonites a dry denomination? Do they have alcohol? Do they drink as adults?
They basically don't after they're part of the church.
Okay.
I would say the one exception is, again, there are some Swiss Amish in Indiana where alcohol would be permitted, and actually it leads to some problems for them. But in general, in most of the Amish communities, it would be very unusual to be using particularly beer or alcohol on a regular basis. Interestingly, they do, all the Old Order groups use wine in their communion service, and there are a few families that may make some homemade wine, but they're not, you know, it wouldn't be a really rigid taboo, but in general, there's very little use of alcohol after they're, you know, full members of the church.
Okay. Here's another demographic question that has puzzled me, and some of the answer to this is somewhat alleviated by the large population. 290,000 Amish is amazingly large, much larger than I thought it would be. But this question comes from Gene Schoberg, and he's wondering about the Amish being a relatively closed community, closed from the outside world. There's probably not going to be a great deal of outmarriage going on there. How do they manage marriage relations? Especially, Gene was interested in this question about genetic pools, and we understand that a great deal of variety is important for a population when it comes to mating. How do the Amish and the Old Order Mennonites deal with marriage and mating issues?
Mm. Well, first of all, there are no arranged marriages. That's another urban myth. Young people are free to select and marry who they want, but the Amish are endogamous and the Old Order Mennonites are endogamous, which means that a bishop and church leaders will only marry a couple if both of them are members of the church. So if a young man, let's say, developed a romance with a outside woman who grew up Presbyterian, they would need, and they want to get married, she could join the Amish, and that happens sometimes, or he would need to leave. In other words, the Amish bishop's not going to marry an Amish boy and a Presbyterian girl. So they are endogamous. All of them would have restrictions on marrying first cousins. I mean, it would just be, it's just understood and would not be permitted. On some occasions, second cousins are married. The diversity is an issue more for some of the more rural, traditional groups where they don't interact a lot with other Amish groups. But in other settlements where there's many more Amish and different kinds of Amish, you know, there's cross marriage between different kind of groups. There is a founder's effect in some of the genetic things, which does result in certain diseases expressing themselves more in the Amish church. But on the other side of the coin, then, there are certain diseases they don't get as much because of the founder's effect. So it cuts both ways.
Very interesting. I want to move along in our last 10 minutes here or so, dealing with the economy, and you've written about that, and we've had a question coming in from Adam Gurry, and it's also related to Tobin Grant's question, too, about how the economy of the Amish has changed over time. Again, the stereotypical image is that they're all farmers, but there's this question of farmland becoming scarce over time. And if you have large families and you know, try to divide up either the farmland or just give it to the eldest son, you start to run out of things for the younger siblings to do. So how has the Amish economy been diversifying over time?
In 1950, it probably would be pretty accurate to say 95% of the Amish were farming, and the 5% that weren't were in farm-related ancillary businesses connected to farming. I would sort of see the last quarter of the 20th century since 1975. Since that time, there's been a fairly rapid movement into small businesses. There would be over 12,000 Amish-owned and operated small businesses in the United States today and the different states. Having said that, the number of farmers is still sizable because the population is growing so rapidly, but only about a third of them actually earn their living directly from farming. But in many cases, you'd have a farmstead where there may be three or four families across some generations living there, and one or two of them are getting their income from the farming. The others are working outside in a factory, or they have a small business on the farm, or that sort of thing. The new thing, and we address this in the chapter on the Amish, we have a chapter on agriculture there. There is a really new thing that has happened to kind of renovate and rejuvenate Amish farming in the last 10 years, and that has been produce farming. There's been this kind of happy marriage between the outside consumer economy that wants locally grown vegetables and fruits and products. They can see where they were grown or they have been grown within 50 miles, and the Amish capacity and value system to support produce farming. Because one of the things that the Amish liked about traditional farming was it was family-friendly, and there was work for all the kids, and the kids could work together with the parents. And so today, instead of needing 100 acres to support a small farm, you can support a family with 5 or 6 acres just raising produce. And it's, again, very family-friendly, and there are some 75 to 80 produce auctions across the country, many of them developed by Amish Old Order Mennonite people. And so they bring their vegetables and fruits and flowers and so on to these produce auctions. And the bidders are often commercial chain stores or regional grocery stores that are there bidding against each other for these products. And so that has really enhanced this new development in Amish agriculture, basically small produce farming. And it's been a way of rejuvenating Amish agriculture, but it's very different to the old, having 10, 20, 30 cows as they did in the past.
There must be an increasing amount of profit to be made in that as well. And one would wonder what these smaller family farms or maybe small co-ops actually do with those resources. I mean, I immediately would go out and get a 62-inch flat-screen TV, but that's off the table. So how is their increased wealth, their growing economy being reinvested?
Well, I would say one thing that happens are the bulk of their wealth comes back into the community. For example, they don't have commercial health care. So if a family has a $50,000 hospital bill, the community is going to help to take care of that. So the people that have means and wealth in the community many times are being very generous in terms of their philanthropy inside the community. Another thing that happens to the wealth is purchasing land or property for investment. They may purchase wooded areas or farms in other states. And a third way is there's a kind of internal borrowing. It's kind of an informal Amish credit union where people with wealth would make it available at a low rate of interest for young couples who are starting a business or starting a farm or building a house or whatever. So I would say in general, Tony, it tends to circulate in the community. In our Lancaster area here, there's a group of Amish people with some assistance from the outside that recently established a general commercial bank, which says something about the amount of wealth here, and also they're interested in sort of controlling the wealth, so to speak.
As the communities begin to grow economically, and as there's, you know, people are saying, wow, you got some great vegetables here, let's start purchasing this, one can imagine there's going to be a great deal of interaction and possibly increasing interaction with the Amish community, with the non-Amish world. How has that been over time, and has there been growing harassment? Has there been fairly peaceful relations? What is going on there with the relationship with the quote-unquote outside world?
I would say it really varies a great deal from community to community. You remember I said earlier in our discussion that there are some 470 different physical geographical communities in 31 states.
Right.
That I would say the one generalization I can make is that in the old communities like Lancaster, eastern Pennsylvania, northern Indiana around Goshen, Shipshawana, Holmes County and sort of eastern central near the town of Worcester in Ohio, these are like old communities that have long-standing patterns of friendly getting along and being very neighborly with their outside English neighbors. I would say typically there's a lot of collaboration, cooperation there. Where the problems arise more is in new settlements. I mean, each year there are new physical settlements go into different states. And for example, New York has been a big growth state, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Missouri. And so when Amish people, if there's 25 or 30 families move into an area and don't have a history with the local officials, sometimes it's a rough ride there where the local officials don't quite understand them, and so there may be zoning issues or whatever that can be problematic. But I would say in general, there's amicable relationships.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about one incident, and you wrote about this extensively in your book, Amish Grace, the West Nickel Mine School shooting in 2006. Tell us what happened there and how the community, both the Amish community and the non-Amish community, reacted to this.
The event took place on October 2nd, 2006, about 25 miles here from where I'm sitting today. It was a one-room Amish school with 26 pupils in it, grades 1 to 8. And a local non-Amish person who drove a bulk milk tank around the farms, that was his job, to pick up milk and haul it to a creamery. He came into the schoolhouse about 11 o'clock in the morning, well-armed with three different weapons and paraphernalia and equipment that made it clear he planned to take hostages and hold them there for maybe several days. So he came in to the schoolroom, surprised a teacher. There happened to be several other Amish adults there that day. The teacher took off, ran, and called 911. The offender that came in, it dismissed the other adults, sent the boys out, and was there alone with 10 young girls from first grade through eighth grade. He basically barricaded himself in, pulled the blinds down. The police came in about 15 minutes. They tried to speak with him through bullhorns, talk with him, but I think it irritated him and agitated him because he didn't think. I think it surprised him the teacher ran and called for help. There was no telephone inside the school building.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, he ended up shooting all 10 girls. He tied their legs together. They were in their stomachs. He shot into the back of them. Five of them died. Five survived. Of the five survivors, four are doing very well today, more than 5 years after this event. And the one, though, is sort of needs 24/7 care.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a horrific event, unprovoked. You know, it's just utter surprise to everybody. And within about 6 or 7 hours, three Amish men just kind of spontaneously went to the widow of the man that did the shooting and expressed their sorrow, their compassion, forgiveness, said they wanted her to continue living there, they wanted to be good neighbors. And at the same time, another Amish man, neither of these groups knew what was happening, another Amish group went to the parents' home of the man that did the shooting, and the same thing, just stayed there for an hour or so, saying, we forgive you, we want to continue to be good neighbors, and so on. So this whole forgiveness, the extension of this grace just soon became news, and within a week there were 2,400 stories, not just about the shooting, but about the Amish forgiveness around the world. It was just shocking, and it seemed like a kind of very unusual thing, almost robotic. I mean, some of the critics and pundits said, well, something's wrong with the Amish. They didn't grieve enough to be doing this. And so it became a major, major story, and it reflects Amish theology here, where they're working. I interviewed about 36 Amish people directly related to the school, and I said, well, why did you express forgiveness and grace like this so quickly? And all of them, without exception, Tony, turned to the Lord's Prayer, the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. They said, well, it's forgiveness is in there. It says, forgive us our debts as we forgive those that trespass against us. And then at the end of that prayer, they said there's two verses. One says, if you forgive, you'll be forgiven. The other says, if you don't forgive, you won't be forgiven. So that is, you know, it's kind of like the Amish idea of what it means to be a disciple and follow Jesus. It's very literal. And it, frankly, it varies from mainstream evangelical theology, which would really emphasize grace. It's kind of like, you know, there's always plenty of grace. It doesn't matter what you do. And the Amish would say, well, there's some strings tied to grace. You know, if you've been forgiven, but you won't pass on the forgiveness, you're not going to always keep getting grace if you're going to be cantankerous and not willing to pass on the forgiveness, so to speak.
Let me ask a final question here, and I always like to do this with my guest. You've been studying the Old Order Mennonites and the Amish for a very long period of time, and you've had a chance to reflect upon this. Your writings are numerous, and there's so many more topics we could have gone into today. So I refer people back to your books, especially the most recent one, The Amish, which is very comprehensive. But reflecting back upon all your research and work with the Amish, what do you take away from all this for us folks in the non-Amish community?
Well, I would say a major takeaway for me personally is just a deep sense of humility. I'm talking now particularly about theology and religious life. You know, in modern life, we try to control everything. We think we're on top of everything. We can control history and make sure that if we strategize properly, we get the proper outcomes. The Amish view is just rooted in a deep philosophical and theological humility, which I think has really shaped me in many ways. Also, I have become much more skeptical of technology. And frankly, I think the Amish are much smarter than we are when it comes to technology. They basically would argue that individuals aren't smart enough to make their own decisions about technology. It's kind of like, Tony, when have you or your listeners gone to their rabbi or their priest or their pastor to ask about, well, should they get the next version of the best smartphone? Well, Amish people would do that. It's basically the collective wisdom of the community is deemed more trustworthy and more valuable than an individual's, decision. And so it has made me more skeptical about technology. I still don't have a smartphone. It's kind of like I got requests for an interview a few days ago, and I was supposed to record it my smartphone. I said, I don't have one. Yes, I have a cell phone, but it's an old 10-year-old, kind of thing. But and I'm not morally opposed to smartphones. I'm just not sure I need one yet. Maybe someday. Finally, would be the sense of community, the importance of community, and the value, the rich value of being a member of a community with a distinctive identity. And how we find that, whether it's through a faith community of some kind, you know, having a people and having an identity and a communal support system is, in my judgment, just really very important.
My guest today has been Donald Crable. Don, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.